Today is Friday, May 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, what is next for Northeast Asia now that the United States has called off a June 12th summit with North Korea?
The structural equilibrium remains the same.
Plus, the Netherlands and Australia blame Russia for the downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. And plus, we take a look at the latest Star Wars movie in the franchise, featuring, as Princess Leia put it, a certain stuck-up, half-witted, scruffy-looking Nerf herder. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. Well, will there or won't there be a U.S.-North Korean summit? U.S. President Donald Trump said on Friday there is still a possibility.
No, we'll see what happens. It could even be the 12th. We're talking to them now. They very much want to do it. We'd like to do it. We're going to see what happens.
Since taking office, South Korean President Moon Jae-in has spent considerable time engaging with Pyongyang, sitting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's sister during the Winter Olympics as they cheered a United Korea marching during the opening ceremony, and even having his own summit with Kim in April. So what does President Trump's letter on Thursday canceling the summit mean for President Moon? That's the question I posed to Daniel Pinkston, lecturer on international relations at Troy University in Seoul.
Well, for President Moon and his two liberal or so-called progressive predecessors, President Kim Dae-jung and Noh Moo-hyun, they have had a policy and a strategy of engagement whereby they had planned and they seek to interact with North Korea in order to transform the thinking and the perceptions and the identity and the interests of North Korea. You know, there are emotional reasons, political reasons, legal reasons, constitutional reasons why, you know, South Korean president has to engage in this endeavor. So he's doing what he's supposed to do. Whether or not it's successful, you know, we just have to wait and see. The summit in Washington just a few days ago, it was very telling when he gave a statement, or he mentioned that just because these efforts in the past have failed and failed many times, it does not mean that we have to give up or that we should give up. And at some point, the hope is that at some point there will be success and North Korea will be transformed and will have different perception of the world and will be willing to abandon its weapons of mass destruction. But in my view, we have to see some change in North Korean thinking. We have to measure actions and behavior, not just hopes or wishful thinking on the outside on our part, because I think there's a pretty strong consensus where North Korea needs to go.
So where do we go from here? Are we back to this whole status quo with North Korea where there's a cyclical pattern of heightened tensions and then they wane and relax only to repeat itself later?
That very well could be the case. What we have in Northeast Asia, despite so much focus on these episodic events or, you know, where a summit might be held in this meeting or that meeting or some press statement, the overall situation and the structural equilibrium remains the same. And we're stuck in this suboptimum equilibrium whereby every actor is dissatisfied with something about the status quo. All of the actors are dissatisfied about something and would like the status, like to change the status quo. But the problem is, for any single actor, if it were to try to change the status quo unilaterally through the use of force, it would fail.
A criticism of the summit was that it gave North Korea what it always wanted, a meeting with a sitting U.S. president. Now, while both North Korea and the United States appear to have somewhat left the door open for a future meeting, what does the cancellation do for North Korea and Kim Jong-un?
That recognition that was extended is something they will pocket and, you know, move forward with their long-term strategy. So in the future, hopefully, I would like a summit to be successful. I would like North Korea to change its orientation and to embark upon a more cooperative relationship with the outside world, including the United States. But all of the groundwork and all of the working level issues that have to be resolved before a summit, how it's normally done, did not take place. This was a very kind of impulsive, spur-of-the-moment decision by Trump. South Korean government officials from the Blue House, National Security Advisor, steps out on the White House driveway and announces this to the press. This is a very, very important foreign policy initiative on the part of the U.S., and the U.S., the State Department, U.S. officials are not even, you know, looped into this. They're not the spokesman for announcing this. And so this was bound to happen. So the fact that it happened sooner rather than later is maybe a blessing, as opposed to getting further down, you know, the process and it rupturing even in a worse way. So if this can be reconstituted in a positive way, then maybe it can be done right.
Daniel Pinkston is a lecturer on international relations at Troy University in Seoul.
Beginning Friday, May 25th, companies that collect or process the personal information of European Union residents must comply with new rules that protect the privacy of people's data. The rollout of the General Data Protection Regulation has been welcome, but is also causing confusion, not to mention a lot of emails popping up in your inbox alerting you to the policy changes of technology services you use. Companies are trying to understand what level of protection different data needs, whether this could force them to change the way they do business and innovate, and how to manage the EU's 28 national data regulators who enforce the law. That uncertainty, together with stiff penalties for violating the law, has convinced internet-based businesses such as Unroll.me, an inbox management firm, and gaming company Ragnarok Online to block EU users from their sites. And U.S. retailer Pottery Barn? Well, that company says it will no longer ship to EU addresses. So, what is the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR for short? Reuters' Scarlett Vitanovich has that story.
The aim is to force companies to manage the data customers sign over to them in a safe way. It applies to any identifying information such as your name, address, religious beliefs, or sexual orientation. The GDPR means people living in the EU can expect clear information about who is processing their data and why, access to the data held about them, the right to have personal data corrected or erased. Reuters technology editor Douglas Buzfine.
There's a feeling that these big platform companies, the social media, the e-commerce companies from Silicon Valley know too much about us, that they're collecting data, they're doing corporate surveillance. And in Europe, politicians, the people don't like it so much.
GDPR won't just apply to businesses based in the EU, but to any company that has customers in the EU. For those firms, it means no more hiding privacy consents and general terms and conditions, keeping records of all the data held, a 72-hour deadline for reporting serious data breaches, fines of up to 4% of annual revenue for serious infringements. GDPR will be policed by EU watchdogs, and big companies must now appoint a data protection officer to ensure they're on top of the law.
That was Reuters reporter Scarlett Vitanovich, and privacy group Noibe.eu has already filed complaints against Facebook, Google, Instagram, and WhatsApp. Here are some other top stories from around the globe. The warring parties in South Sudan's civil war are facing renewed international pressure to honor a ceasefire and reach a peace deal after failing to reach any kind of agreement at talks in Addis Ababa this week. A Democratic Republic of Congo government official says 50 people have died in a boat accident in a remote northern region of the country. And Canadian police say two men who walked into a restaurant in Ontario and detonated an improvised explosive device. Officials say three people were critically wounded. For additional stories as well as in-depth coverage, please visit our website, voanews.com, or download our mobile app to take the stories with you. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A couple of hundred million years ago, geologists say most of Earth's landmass was in one supercontinent called Pangaea. Then about 200 to 175 million years ago, the supercontinent began to slowly break up into the seven continents we have today. A new study in Nature suggests the discovery of a nearly 130 million-year-old fossilized skull provides evidence that Pangaea may have lasted longer than thought. The skull is from a newly discovered extinct species, which is thought to be part of a group that that might be an evolutionary bridge between reptiles and mammals. The authors of the study suggest that this new species and those from some other vertebrate groups existed throughout the world about 145 million years ago. It's thought this means the animal's migration pathways across an intact Pangaea continued for another 15 million years later than was previously believed. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Friday, the Netherlands and Australia said they are holding Russia legally responsible and will seek compensation for the downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 over war-ravaged eastern Ukraine nearly 4 years ago, killing all 298 passengers and crew on board. VOA's Martin Sechrist has more.
Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop blamed Russia for the downing of a Malaysian Airlines passenger jet over eastern Ukraine in 2014, killing all 298 aboard, including 38 Australians.
Australia and the Netherlands have now informed the Russian Federation that we hold it responsible under international law for its role in the bringing down of MH17.
Dutch Foreign Minister Stef Blok said it has now been indisputably proven that there is a direct link between the rocket that hit MH17 and the Russian army. Blok also says that a possible next step would be presenting the case to an international court. He said the Netherlands and Australia have asked Russia to enter into talks aimed at finding a solution that would do justice to the tremendous suffering and damage caused by the downing of MH17. Bishop demanded answers from Russia.
Why is it that a sophisticated advanced weapon belonging to the Russian army, a Buk missile, was transported into eastern Ukraine, into territory controlled then by the Russian-backed separatists, brought down a civilian aeroplane?
International investigators announced Thursday that the missile system that brought down the Amsterdam-Kuala Lumpur flight came from a Russia-based military unit. Russia said Friday the Netherlands had provided no evidence to support the claim, accusing the Dutch of promoting their own agenda. The Russian Defense Ministry said the missile, more than likely, came from Ukrainian arsenals. However, Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop says the findings represent a threat to international security.
If military weapons can be deployed and then used to bring down civilian aircraft in what was essentially a war zone, then international security is at risk.
MH17 was shot down over territory held by pro-Russian separatist forces in eastern Ukraine in 2014 as it flew from Amsterdam en route to Kuala Lumpur. Victims were from 10 nations. Martin Sechrest, VOA News.
The United Nations Refugee Agency expressed alarm at what it says is a significant increase in the number of people fleeing violence and persecution in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Lisa Schlein has that story from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 294,000 asylum seekers and refugees from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador were forced to flee their homes in 2017, a 58% increase from the previous year. It says the vast majority have fled to Belize, Mexico, and the United States, and increasingly to Costa Rica and Panama in search of refugee protection. UNHCR spokeswoman Ekaterina Kitidi says many are vulnerable women and children who are unaccompanied or separated from their families.
We hear repeatedly from people requesting refugee protection, including from a growing number of children, that they are fleeing forced recruitment into armed criminal gangs and death threats. As people journey across borders and onwards, they face numerous dangers, including violence at the hands of criminal groups, often leaving women in particular vulnerable to sexual abuse and exploitation.
The Trump administration says it will separate children from parents who enter the United States illegally. Katidi notes some circumstances could necessitate putting a child into care. For example, when the relationship between the child and parent is questionable, and especially when trafficking is suspected. But she tells VOA preserving the family unit is a fundamental tenet of refugee protection. She says the unity of the family should be preserved in the best interest of children and of society as a whole.
Most of the people who attempt to enter to the United States across the southern border are coming from these three Central American countries, which is Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, which are experiencing high levels of violence and persecution, often targeting children and youth and forcing families to flee to protect their lives.
Katidi says the UNHCR believes government policies should be based on the best interests of children and society. She says detention always should be the last resort and special facilities should be provided to ensure family unity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. This week, a newsmaker interview with Congressman Jim Costa, a Democrat from the state of California. We'll talk with Congressman Costa about a range of domestic and foreign policy issues facing the United States. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, friends. This is Sunday Shomari, host of Let's Talk. Join me Monday for another exciting edition of your show. Our topic next week will be volunteering in Africa. This is Monday at 7:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Disgraced movie mogul Harvey Weinstein was arraigned in court on Friday in New York City on sexual assault charges. The AP's Julie Walker has more.
Harvey Weinstein stood stoically in court, wearing a blazer with his hands cuffed behind his back as the prosecutor read the rape and other sexual assault charges he faces. Weinstein's lawyer handed over his client's passport and offered up a cashier's check for $1 million bail. Weinstein will have to wear an electronic ankle monitor and can't leave New York or Connecticut, where he has a home. The 66-year-old did not speak in court, but did nod his head when asked if he understood the terms of his bail. Weinstein has denied any allegations of non-consensual sex. Julie Walker, New York.
Star Wars fans, well, you don't need to wait any longer. Another Star Wars installment opens on screens across the globe this weekend. Solo, a Star Wars story, traces the beginnings of the friendship between Han Solo and Chewbacca. And VOA's Penelope Pulu has that box office preview.
I'm going to be a pilot. Best in the galaxy.
Hey, kid. I'm putting together a crew. You in?
That's yes.
I'm very happy playing Chewbacca. I couldn't be happier about this film, because just to have everyone see this, how Han and Chewbacca first met and be with us on that adventure is just warms my heart tremendously.
2-meter-tall Star Wars fan Jonas Suotamo could not believe his luck when he first received the casting call to play the legendary Wookiee, originally portrayed by Peter Mayhew. The former professional basketball player appeared in the last four Star Wars films under the Chewbacca costume, but he says his role in this installment was the most demanding yet.
Because it's so physical. I mean, there are things that Chewbacca needed to do that involve choosing a more athletic approach into filming.
Since when do you know how to fly? 190 years old? You look great.
As in the film, offstage, Suotamo struck a friendship with newcomer Alden Ehrenreich, who plays the young, unpredictable, and cocky Han Solo, the role originally played by Harrison Ford.
Jonas playing Chewie, who was so good at playing Chewie, is just funny. He's just, anything he does in the suit is funny, and he really knows how to, use the suit to its best comic effect.
Not an easy feat, says Suotamo, considering the suit is hot and heavy. The actor says he sustained neck injuries due to the extra weight he had to carry on his head during grueling 10-hour shoots.
You're gonna need a nickname, because I ain't saying that every time.
Directed by Ron Howard, the rest of the cast is equally engaging, from Woody Harrelson, who plays Outlaw Beckett, to Solo's love interest, Kira, played by Game of Thrones star Emilia Clarke.
Push it!
Another central character is Solo's spaceship, the Millennium Falcon.
Thought we were in trouble there for a second, but it's fine. We're fine.
You see a lot of maneuvers and a lot of adventures with the ship that I think are a step further than you've ever seen in a Star Wars movie.
But some fear that Solo, a Star Wars story, coming only 5 months after the release of the blockbuster Star Wars The Last Jedi, may not break the box office like its predecessors. Many say that the story is not as relevant to the original trilogy, and others suggest that after the release of 8, soon to be 9, Star Wars films in just a few years, audiences may have had enough. Jonas Suotamo doesn't share those concerns.
I love the Star Wars franchise. I love the stories, and I love these new films, and I think it's a great time to be a Star Wars fan.
He couldn't have said it better. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Star Wars. All right, my friends. That's going to do it for me today. I'd like to thank Patrice Martin for directing today's show, as well as Nick Ivanov for engineering the broadcast. But most importantly, I want to thank you for spending part of your day listening to us. If you haven't already, please follow Voice of America on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where you'll find pictures, videos, stories, and more. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns the fraudulent election that took place in Venezuela on May 20th. This so-called election, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, is an attack on constitutional order and an affront to Venezuela's tradition of democracy. Until the Maduro regime restores a democratic path in Venezuela through free, fair, and transparent elections, the government faces isolation from the international community. The electoral process, said Mr. Pompeo, was choreographed by a regime too unpopular and afraid of its own people to risk free elections and open competition. It stacked the Venezuelan courts and National Electoral Council with biased members aligned with the regime. It silenced dissenting voices. It banned major opposition parties and leaders from participating. Human rights abuses remain a prominent feature of the Maduro regime. As of May 14th, some 338 political prisoners remain jailed, more than in all countries in the hemisphere combined. The regime stifled the free press and state sources dominated media coverage, unfairly favoring the incumbent. Most contemptible of all, said Secretary Pompeo, the regime selectively parceled out food to manipulate the votes of hungry Venezuelans. Indeed, most Venezuelans struggle to make ends meet as the economy remains in complete freefall, with the Bolivar Fuerte currency down 99% in the past year and inflation at an annual 14,000%, according to the National Assembly. Numerous countries in the hemisphere and throughout the international community condemned Venezuela's sham election. The Lima Group, made up of 14 countries throughout the Western Hemisphere, denounced the vote as failing to meet international standards of democratic, free, just, and transparent process. The group, which includes Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, and Colombia, announced their intention to reduce their level of diplomatic relations with Venezuela and encourage international and regional organizations to not issue Venezuela additional credit that could be used by the regime to further oppress the Venezuelan people. The United States, said Secretary Pompeo, stands with democratic nations in support of the Venezuelan people and will take swift economic and diplomatic actions to support the restoration of their democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.